Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us, hopefully on the line in just a moment, a General Romeo Dallaire, and we're going to be talking about his book, Shake Hands with the Devil. And it's a powerful, powerful book. It's a book that everybody needs to read and understand really the evil that we're really up against in the world today. Because it's the story of General Dallaire's experience there in Rwanda in 1994. And, of course, he was the commander of the UN force that was there. And facing what was obviously going to be a genocide, he cried out. He did everything he possibly could to get help to prevent what took place. And, of course, he was completely he was even forbidden to intervene and stop what was taking place. Well, with that as a background, General Dallaire, are you there?
I am there.
Thank you so very much for being with us. And I appreciate so much your writing the book, Shake Hands with the Devil, because I think it's so important that our theme on this program is to try to get people to understand that there really is organized evil in the world today.
That certainly is close to being an understatement, I'm afraid.
Well, of course, you were there. Why don't you give our listeners just a little of the background about who you are. You have your lieutenant general in the general in the Canadian military, and you were actually given this assignment, and you were to be there to help certainly supervise the transition to peace in Rwanda. I'm going to let you sort of pick the story up there.
Well, and after 30-odd years, based on NATO Central Europe classic warfare, peacekeeping in the 90s took on a whole different perspective as we entered an era of complex conflict and intrastate imploding nations that were trying to bring democracy and rule of law, and Rwanda was one such place. And they had finally agreed after 3 years of war to have a peace agreement, and they needed a referee to make sure everybody plays by the rules and brings it about. And since 1956, the Canadian Foreign Minister at the time, Lester B. Pearson, created for Suez the Blue Berets. Blue Berets have been the UN peacekeepers have been the referees in such conflicts, and so we ended up in Rwanda with a lot of optimism that we would solve this horrific civil war, only to find that over a period of 6 months the extremists undermined the whole process, and as such, because of the international community's lack of interest, because there was nothing there except humans, as I was told by one representative of a nation, the country was let down and essentially fell into a civil war again, and what's worse, the genocide.
And of course, when you say there was nothing there but humans, you mean there was no oil, there was no diamonds, there was no gold, there was nothing to exploit from the point of view of the world. And the only people there were the humans, and nobody seemed to be very concerned about them.
Well, in fact, you're absolutely right. And the other dimension that we have seen come to the fore, which I think is even worse than during the colonial era, is that the developed world has actually identified a prioritization in humanity, and the sub-Sahara Africans have found themselves to be the lowest priority.
Hold that thought right there, please. Well, please go right ahead. You were just saying that the sub-Saharan Africans were really found to be on the lowest priority. Nobody was really concerned about them.
No, and unless those countries can have either a geographic strategic value or a resource value, the self-interest-based developed world simply doesn't go in there to often respond to a crisis, let alone have the courage to go in to prevent a crisis from happening.
Well, of course, apparently there were two racial groups. There was one, and they were the Tutsis, and the other was the Hutus. And yet, of course, when you described your initial visit to the Tutsi camp, and of course they were the people, they were known as they were the force that was trying to take back control of the country. Why, there were actually Hutus there working, and there were Hutu officers along with the Tutsi officers, weren't there?
Yes, well, in fact, the Tutsis who were thrown out in 1959, who were trying to come back to their country in 1990 because Museveni in Uganda was forcing them to go away from those refugee camps and go back to Rwanda, they found themselves having to fight their way back in, and the Hutu majority did not want them to come back because historically the Tutsis, due to the colonial powers, were the dominant group, and they were only 14% of the population.
Well, it wasn't an example when the Belgians were there, where they sort of played one group against the other, and they used the Tutsis to be the administrative class, oppressing the Hutus. But wasn't this pretty part of the colonial era, playing one tribal group against another tribal group?
Well, in fact, that's what all the colonial powers did. And so I find it very difficult to stand there and watch the French, the Italians, the British, the Dutch, less so, the Portuguese and Spaniards going into Africa to say that they are looking for reconciliation and peacekeeping when, in fact, so many of the conflicts that are going on now on that continent are directly due to policies by these colonial countries, the European countries of the past. And we're now finding ourselves trying to resolve conflicts that have been festering for over a century.
And of course, this is a great tragedy, and are the tribal loyalties. I know I lived in South Africa for a time, and I think the average individual here in the United States finds it very difficult to believe the animosity that exists between tribal units.
Well, it is one that comes from the fact that so many of them have been either crushed together because...
Oh, hold that thought, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is General Dallaire, and he was, of course, given the opportunity or the responsibility to be in command of the United Nations forces in Rwanda as they were trying to come up with a peace agreement between the two warring factions there. There was an agreement, and, of course, the United Nations was to enforce it, and they were to establish a democratic or representative government. And, of course, but there seemed to be terribly deep-seated animosities between the Tutsis and the Hutus. And yet, of course, one of the things that impressed me so much when I read your book, that when you first went to that camp where the head of the Tutsis was, they referred him to as the Napoleon of Africa, because, of course, he was a brilliant military strategist who had actually, on several occasions, defeated the French forces. He had Hutu officers there with him, didn't he?
Yes, well, there was, over the years, from the revolutionary time in 1959 when he threw out the Belgians, and, of course, through a couple of coups, there was still a sizable population of Tutsis, about 1 million out of the 8.3 million in the country. And there had been a lot of reconciliation at the grassroots level. I mean, there was intermarriage going on, and there were a lot of, as I would say, moderate Hutus and moderate Tutsis who saw themselves in a very strong communion to build their nation. They've got the same historic past. They have their same common language, which is Kinyarwanda. They're all essentially Christian, either Catholic or Protestant. And so there were lots of fine opportunities to link these two together, and that's why you found that in the Tutsi group that was trying to come back, a number of Hutu moderates who had been abused by the hardline government, Hutu government, and had joined the Tutsi forces.
All right, so you are then there, and you're in the capital city, and you've got a UN force, and it's got Bangladeshis, it's got Belgians, it's got Tunisians. You've got all sorts of units from all over the world. About how many men did you have under your command?
Well, I had just under 2,500 coming from 26 different nations. All of them having their own sort of quality of training and equipment and ethos. And as an example, I would have some from countries that had absolutely no respect for human rights, and yet they were there as a part of a UN force to enforce human rights or to at least ensure that it was being respected. And so as a field commander, you are given these forces who are loaned from their nations to the UN to do these jobs.
And of course you really didn't have all the equipment and the things that you needed really from the force, the material things, the war making things you needed, did you?
Well, in fact, what happens is that the UN historically for peacekeeping was very much a rich man's game. That is to say that the UN has no equipment, has no army, and nor do we ever want it to have its own army. But the only nations that could actually go and do peacekeeping would be the nations that were rich enough to send troops with the equipment, with the sustainability logistics to do this. Well, in the 90s, we saw these developed countries pulling back and more the developing nations filling in the gaps. It's sort of like the fall of the Roman Empire, where they were using no more Romans or sons of Romans to fight the wars on the borders. They were using barbarians or others. And so we have sort of moved that same way, where we're using countries who need the money and through the funding that the UN provides for their troops and are dependent on people giving equipment to them. And so the UN is begging and borrowing not only troops who are from a less caliber and less capable background, but it's also on its knees begging those nations who have equipment to lend it or to give it.
Well, of course, you tell the story that, you're there and a little uncertain what's going to happen. There are these two warring factions, but you're supposed to be there to supervise this transition to peace. And you go off to somewhere in the north and you find a band of children who've been just brutally slaughtered. And, of course, all the evidence points to it. It's the Tutsi unit that's done this. And you begin wondering what this is really all about, who slaughtered the children and why they were really slaughtered, and why evidence was left there to suggest it was the Tutsis rather than the Hutu forces.
Well, you're absolutely right. Remembering that the UN force that was there was a peacekeeping force, and which is under the parlance of the UN, out of the Charter at Chapter 6 mission. And under Chapter 6, what the UN force can do is observe and report. We're like the referee. We are not an enforcer in regards to an intervention force. We're there because both sides want peace and they need somebody just to make sure we're playing by the rules. And so we observe and report what's going on. We do not have the force structure nor mandate from the countries nor the Security Council to actually enforce. Now, what happened in that circumstance is that within about a month, we started to realize that, one, those who wanted us to come in the country to implement the peace agreement were the moderates. They were the moderate Hutus, and they were essentially the Tutsis and the bulk of them moderate, only to then realize that a subversive force was building itself up because they had not signed in a formal fashion the peace agreement, and they were looking at how to scuttle the whole affair. And so they started the campaign of disinformation, like blaming the Tutsis or the rebel forces, which were Tutsis, for local small-scale massacres, when in fact it made absolutely no sense nor tactically, nor logically, that the Tutsis would be doing such events.
And, of course, you actually later on found that many of the people that actually were working with you were actually secret agents of the Hutu, and these were the violent, or the very, really the radical Hutus who wanted a major bloodbath. And there were people actually coming and telling you that what was going to happen, that they were preparing for this bloodbath.
Oh, it is out of the story is nearly one out of a Greek tragedy. My headquarters, because we hire locals, translators, secretarial staff, support staff, and so on, as per the norm, the Hutu extremists, who were the ruling party under the president, maneuvered to have their people on a number of occasions hired. And so they were reporting, my headquarters was riddled by these informants. And what we were discovering by the third month we were there, because one of these extremist militiamen actually wanted safe conduct out of the country and was willing to give us all the information, which he gave us a lot, that they were actually implementing a final solution. And it sounds so much like, in fact, the Second World War and the Nazi system. And their final solution that they came up with was the only way to get this situation sorted out was essentially to eliminate this other ethnic group. And so they started the process of planning in detail how to first decapitate, and I speak literally, the Hutu moderates and all the Tutsi leadership, and then proceed to an outright genocidal action.
And, of course, it was going to be the Hutus who would not turn against their Tutsi neighbors. So the Hutus, even though the radicals really were Hutus themselves, they would kill anybody who opposed them. Was that a fair statement?
Well, in fact, the what became quite evident is that whenever there was any sort of scenario of opposition, they would essentially call these Hutus collaborators, and they would be eliminated. And one of the ways they would do that is to have these people literally kill the Tutsi neighbors, or in other circumstances, have the children of a mixed marriage kill the Tutsi adult. And so created these incredible situations of perverse cleansing and proof that you are a true Hutu by right on the spot demanding that you eliminate the other one, and if you don't, they simply kill you outright. And so a lot of the killing was done by the general population, and in there the bulk of the killing were done by youths, many of them disenfranchised, who had nothing to lose. Others simply coerced into this action.
And my understanding is that the people had no guns, no weapons, nothing to defend themselves with. And that is why, of course, when the Hutus had machetes, they were able then, of course, to be so effective in their genocide, because the Hutus, the population, Hutu population, had nothing to defend themselves with.
Well, small arms is the dominant weapon system of the continent. And because of the end of the Cold War, a lot of small arms became redundant, and instead of being destroyed, they were sold. And also a number, in particular the Eastern European countries, continued to produce a lot of these weapons because it was the basis of their economy, and so they were sold to less than credible governments or the like, and so you have a proliferation of these small arms. However, you don't need much of it to dominate a society where the only defensive means they have is the fundamental instruments of agriculture, which is the machete. And so anybody, even a 9-year-old child with a machine gun, has enormous amount of power there.
And of course, this, of course, is an incredible story of a man's inhumanity to man. And of course, General Dallaire was there, and as we get into this story, you'll find out what happened, and of course, thwarted at every turn. As he tried to do something, as he saw this impending slaughter coming, and of course, because of restrictions placed on him, was helpless to do anything about it. Well, you tell about the what happened to some of the Belgian soldiers there, and what was that all about? How did that play into what was happening, and how did that influence what happened after that? Weren't a number of Belgian soldiers actually slaughtered initially as the genocide began?
Yes, well, in fact, it comes from, and I'm sorry to say, from the American experience in Mogadishu. And that happened in October of 93, and we must remember that the genocide started in April 94, so barely 6 months later. And what had happened in Mogadishu is the fact that when these 18 Rangers were killed and a few of them were dragged in the streets of Mogadishu, President Clinton ordered the U.S. forces out of Somalia and abandoned essentially the U.N. and other countries and the Somalis to the warlords. Well, it became quite clear to the extremists that if they were able to kill a number of white soldiers, then they would break the will of the developing countries' interest in these humanitarian-based missions, remembering that these missions have nothing to do with our security or even our national interest, and so you're doing it because of humanity. And if you sustained casualties, then the governments back in the developed countries don't seem to have the courage or political will to sustain the operations with casualties and essentially pull the troops out. And so what they had done, and we were aware that they would try to pull this off, and they did, was to sucker in a section of Belgian soldiers and eliminate them, killed 10 of them outright in the first 24 hours. The Belgians' initial reaction by their military was to reinforce and to sort this thing out. Within another 24, nearly 36 hours, the Belgian political side kicked in and they decided to pull out. And so exactly what the extremists wanted happened. The Belgian force was my most effective force on the ground, about 450 though. They decided to pull out, and in order to cover their tracks, they also convinced everybody else to pull out. And so I could not use the forces that were given to me because their national capitals were essentially pulling them out from under me.
And so, basically then, when the genocide started, and you knew it was going to happen, did you actually ever request permission to use whatever force you could to try to intervene, to try to head this off, or to take the machetes or the other weapons that the Hutus were going to use?
Yes, in fact, when that informant, as I spoke of earlier on, came to us in January, which is 3 months or so before, I had informed the UN, and that was in New York, the headquarters, that I intended to conduct a number of raids on caches of weapons, machetes, small arms, and the like, in order to destabilize the planning of the extremists, and as such, knew that in the panic of that, they would create situations that would show their hand, and then I'd be able to actually smash their process. New York, gun-shy, terribly gun-shy, out of the Mogadishu scenario, apart from the fact that they were also concerned that my mandate did not give me the authority to do that, meaning that the countries who had lent the troops to the UN lent them under a mandate of the...
Hold that thought right there, please.
Yes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is General Dallaire, and he was the commander of the United Nations forces in Rwanda. And what had happened, he knew what was going to happen, and informed it had come to him, and actually told him what was going to happen, and so he'd gone to the United Nations and tried to get permission to carry out raids and actually capture these weapons before the genocide began. But the people in New York, at the United Nations headquarters, they would not authorize you to go ahead and proceed with these raids?
No, because their arguments were the following. One, they were concerned it was a trap and that I would take casualties and as such have a scenario like Mogadishu and people would pull out. But secondly, and most significantly, was the fact that a mandate under Chapter 6 does not give me authority to take such offensive actions. And in so doing, they went by the book, where I was trying to push the limits of a mandate and pursue, in fact, such what I ultimately call deterrent operations. Now, what dominated the background to their decision was the fact that the nations who had lent the troops to the UN were not lending them to do anything but observing and reporting. The Belgians were prepared to take the risks, and those were the guys I wanted to use. But even there, the Belgians backed off, and the Security Council supported the Secretariat in the decision not to conduct these operations.
And so here you are now. You probably could have at least headed this whole thing off or thwarted it, and now you're not allowed to do anything. And so what is your function there? Is it mainly just to protect Americans there, to protect embassies, to protect foreigners? What were you to do at this point? What did they expect you to do if the genocide started? Because here, within a period of 100 days, they slaughtered 800,000 people.
Well, in fact, leading to that genocide, what we continued to do was attrit the position by the UN and the Security Council, and ultimately I was given authority, at nearly arm's length, however, to conduct these raids. But by the time I got that, we were days before the genocide, and so the whole process essentially permitted the extremists to make their plan more efficient. And all they needed was a catalyst to launch it. And so when somebody, and that's still up in the air, of course, for no real investigation has been done, when somebody decided to eliminate the president, that was the launch of the civil war and the genocide. And so during the genocide, or even the civil war, the UN expected me essentially to hunker down or to pull out. And I actually received those orders to do so, to which I refused. And so they did not want us to be an intervention force as that was not in the mandate, and they were not in the Security Council prepared to give me a new mandate.
So essentially what they were saying was, we're going to wash our hands with it, there's going to be a battle, and we will not give you permission. But how many men did you have at this time? You still had, about several thousand men?
Well, I had, to start with, about 2,500.
Right.
Out of that, over 300 were unarmed observers, who are UN observers who have no weapons. The others, the 450, were Belgians who were very capable. But the other forces I had were Bangladeshis who were not capable and very poorly equipped, and Ghanaians whose equipment hadn't arrived yet. So they were essentially carrying their rifles with no vehicles or radios or the like. And so that force very rapidly, within days, became ineffective, one, because their countries, under the pressure from the Belgians and because the Security Council wasn't changing the mandate, their countries gave them the orders to sit tight and to do nothing. And so I couldn't use them. I couldn't give them orders to conduct operations because their countries did not permit them to do that. And they were simply eating the few rations and burning up the fuel. And I was taking casualties of them just standing there and waiting to leave. And so it came to a point where I had to get rid of them, and my plan was to move them to Kenya and from there rebuild the force if people were prepared to reinforce me and then come back in.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment going on with this story of what happened in Rwanda. And then, of course, as it became obvious what was going to happen, and I'm sure that efforts were made to get the truth out to the Western countries. But, of course, the Western countries, and I know in our own nation's capital, because I had articles I cut out of the paper at that time, President Clinton was saying to the people there in his cabinet, don't use the word genocide. Why, if you use the word genocide, we'd have to intervene. Don't mention the word genocide, but that's just what it was. They knew in Washington, D.C. They just didn't care. And, of course, Bill Clinton afterwards said, gee, if we'd only known, why we never would have let it happen. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly as this story began to unfold and you saw what was happening, weren't you frantically trying to get the Western countries to do something? The United States had the military forces to intervene, and they could have, and it wouldn't have taken that large a force, and the British could have done the same thing.
Well, absolutely, and so could have the Canadians. The only countries who can move troops fast enough and effectively enough are essentially the big powers, which is the superpower of your country, the United States, the French, the British, the Chinese, and the Russians are in a whole different world, particularly the Chinese, who have no respect for human rights whatsoever. They don't want to get involved, and the Russians simply were not in a position to do so. And then the other powers are the middle powers, and the middle powers are countries like Canada, Germany, Japan, who are part of the G8. And none of them were also prepared to send the troops. And so right the first morning, I'm afraid that in the Security Council, the Americans set their position of saying, we are not going in to Rwanda and we're going to help no one who wants to, because the presidential directive number 25 that was produced by President Clinton just 3 weeks beforehand essentially said that the United States is not going back into Africa unless it is in its self-interest. And Rwanda had nothing that the Americans were interested in. And so no one wanted to respond to my call for about 5,000 troops. I had just finished commanding a brigade group of 5,200. If I had had that brigade group with me, I would have stopped that genocide. And so for weeks on end, we continued to argue and to fight and to refuse, in fact, ultimately to abandon, as I was ordered, because I had by then about 30,000 Rwandans from both sides under my protection, and we knew they'd be slaughtered within hours of us abandoning them. It took 6 weeks, and that is till the 17th of May. The genocide started on the night of the 6th to 7th of April. And finally, the Security Council agreed that it was a genocide. Finally, it said yes, you can have the 5,000 troops. And by then, we had estimated about 350,000 had been slaughtered. And so the only countries who could respond to me in the short time frame I needed those troops, which is about between 8 and 10 days, would have been these powers which I mentioned. Not one of them responded. On the 8th of June, another 3 weeks, the Security Council agreed to hasten the deployment of this reinforcement, and essentially the first...
Hold that thought right there, please.
Yeah.
Well, General Dalio said that, you know, initially he couldn't get any support at all, but eventually, after 6 weeks or so, why the Security Council admitted it was a genocide going on. By that time, 350,000 people had been killed. And so, but of course, it was only the United States and Great Britain and the others that could bring the people in fast enough to be able to do anything about it. And please pick up the story again, right where we left off.
Right. So I needed those reinforcements within about 10 days, and those countries could have sent them to me. And I wasn't asking for 100,000 troops. I was asking for about 5,000, which any of those countries could have provided and moved them in the time frame that I needed. None of them came forward, and the fear of casualties and also the fact that there was no self-interest, nothing of value in Rwanda, and certainly the position of black Africans being slaughtered was not a factor that was strong enough to move the politicians. By the 8th of June, no one had come in. The Security Council agreed to hasten the deployment, and the first reinforcements arrived, in fact, at the end of July. 2 months after the approval in Security Council, and the troops that arrived were Ethiopians who had absolutely no equipment and no experience in peacekeeping. Not one of the developed nations provided me with any of the troops, and by then, another 450,000 human beings were slaughtered, and over 3 million were internally displaced and refugees.
Well, now, what eventually did end this? Did the Tutsi force from the north come in and put an end to the slaughter? What really ended it?
Well, there again, it's an interesting scenario. The Tutsi force during the Civil War had been within days of taking the capital by its own deployments and was stopped ultimately by the French reinforcing and the Belgians reinforcing the Hutus. And what I found difficult to accept was the fact that the Tutsi force was taking 100 days to in fact win the campaign when they could have done it, in my opinion, in weeks. The Hutu forces, the extremist forces, were very weak and poorly officered, even though they were supported by the French, and the French even came in again to sort of reinforce the Hutus, and in so doing the Hutus thought that the French would fight for them, but this time there was too much of a spotlight on the French. They didn't do that, and ultimately the Hutus ran and the Tutsis won the war.
And that ended it that way. But really then the French were on the side of the people who were committing the genocide.
Well, it is just interesting that only about 3 weeks ago that finally there is going to be a formal internal review of the French forces' role in Rwanda. I remember meeting with the French commander who was deploying forces and remembering that they had gotten agreement from the UN Security Council to deploy on top of that. And so you had the rebel forces on one side, you had the French forces under Chapter 7 with the Hutus, and I'm a Chapter 6 mission in between of them trying to avoid that they start a fight between each other. And the French officers kept complaining that I didn't do enough to stop the Tutsis because they felt that their colleagues who had studied with them in France and Belgium and so on were in fact being disadvantaged.
Well, of course, for our listeners out there, a Category 6 means that you watch and observe and report. A Category 7 means, in military parlance, that you can actually go ahead and engage the enemy. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, exactly.
And, of course, here's the French, who had actually been in there several times before, trying to put down the Tutsis' army. They called them the rebels, but they were just trying to return to their homeland after being driven out. And didn't the Tutsis actually defeat the French on several occasions? Wasn't that one reason why the French really didn't like them?
Well, the French reinforced twice previously in the Civil War, and it came to a standstill. And on this occasion, what was so evident is that the French were supporting their colleagues who had studied with them. The French equipped that army. The French trained that Hutu extremist army. And for them, this was a terrible scenario because it was the first time in Africa, in French Africa in particular, where an army that they had trained and equipped was actually being beaten by another side that they hadn't set up in the first place to do that. And so it was a terrible black mark on the part on the French in regards to their support to allies in French Africa.
Well, of course, was there a religious difference? Was this in any way a religious war between Catholic and Protestant? Were the Hutus predominantly Protestant, or were they predominantly animist? In their background.
Mm. I think that the religious side came more to the fore from the fact that, and I presented that as a paper at Boston College, in fact, last year when I was down there, of a complicity of the Rwandan Catholic Church with the hardline extremist government, because it permitted the policies of separation and advantaging the Hutus against the Tutsis and the like. I think more dominant thematic than religion, although the Tutsis had a larger proportion of Protestants than Catholics, was far more the language. And what you had is a French-based government that was going to be upstarted and, in fact, removed by an English-based government. And so if you go to France, they will argue that, in fact, the Tutsis were American-supported and reinforced, in effort. And if you go to pretty well everywhere else, you'll find out that, the French were supporting and reinforcing the Hutus. And so the argument that comes out is, was this one of the cases of the Americans and the French going at each other through proxies in regards to dominance of Africa? And that scenario is not to be dismissed.
And in fact, as you think then, that the Americans were at least helped to arm that and train the Tutsis?
I would say that they didn't directly arm, because the weapon systems that the Tutsis had were very much Eastern Bloc, Czech, Russian, Chinese.
No, but you have to get money someplace. You can't have an army without money.
There you go. Who was providing the cash bucks? Remembering that the Tutsis had a very strong diaspora in the developed world, the UK, the United States, and Canada. And so there was a fair amount of cash coming in behind the Tutsi movement.
Well, did you ever see the movie Hotel Rwanda?
Yes, I did.
Is that a fair depiction of what happened?
I think it's okay. I think it's okay. It's fiddled with history. It tried to compress a lot of stuff. I think that the hotel manager was used as sort of the catalyst for the movie, although terribly overplayed from what actually happened. I think that some of the ethical and moral quandaries in which we found ourselves, like Nick Nolte playing more or less my role, came out, but it didn't really grasp the smell and the horror of the genocide, and more of the terrible mutilation in regards to moral mutilation as well as physical. It was just too clean, too clinical. And so I've just been reviewing the screenplay of a film. It will be a feature film coming out in 2007 on my book, and I think that you might get a better feel. But Hotel Rwanda is okay. My belief is anything that shows and keeps the Rwandan genocide alive and is decent in doing it, I'll support.
And of course, the thing is that I think that they intentionally played down the violence, the horror, the blood. I think that they didn't want to offend anybody. There were a few scenes there, but they were not as dramatic as they really were they?
No, and I think that leaves, although it's already, because a number of people have told me it surprised them so much, it still does not bring to the fore the extent to which the developed world abandoned the Rwandans to a not a sort of terrible scenario like the tsunami is, but in fact to a man-made scenario that over days and weeks and months saw the outright joy of some people mutilating, raping, and slaughtering others. And that did not come out enough. Not necessarily see all the gore, but what didn't show was the actual near relish of the extremists, and that is why we still have things like Darfur going on, and with very little intervention by the developed world.
How did you feel, and I realize you may not want to answer this question, but how did you feel when you saw President Clinton going over there, during the latter part of his administration, and with tears in his eyes saying, oh, if we just know, we just want to apologize to you?
Yeah. Well, let me set the scenario on that, if I may.
You certainly may, because I just would like your impression of that. I had very, very strong feelings myself.
Well, there you go. He went there in 98, 4 years later, landed, didn't turn his engines off, and for about 3 hours stood at the airport and gave these situation that we didn't know, we hadn't realized it, and if we had known more, we would have done things. And when you look at him, you can say that, yeah, he probably didn't know. But what is still the enormous responsibility that he has and guilt that he should be holding is the fact that he didn't want to know. Because after Mogadishu, he had issued the orders that they were not going to go back into Africa unless it was in the self-interest. And the presidential proclamation, the Directive 25, said that. And so he created an atmosphere in the administration that if this stuff was coming up from the bottom, he didn't want to hear about it. And so it was cut off before it got to his office. So he can say, geez, I didn't know, but where he cannot in any way, shape, or form distance himself from the responsibility of being the superpower, of being the country that's pushing for democracy and for human rights, where he is not allowed to get away, is the fact that he created a scenario in his administration not to know.
And I certainly agree with you. I was highly offended, but I thought this gave hypocrisy a bad name. But be that as it may, you know, certainly just what happened there, then eventually the Tutsi army moves in from the north, mm-hmm. and they're able actually then to put down the Hutus. Now, the Hutus had a much larger army, didn't they? Didn't they have a lot more equipment than the Tutsis?
In fact, yes, but what they lacked was moral fiber and commitment. And essentially what really turned the tide, and this is within about a month of the operations commencing, was the rumors of the French coming in to reinforce them. And so they thought that they, you know, could pull back a bit, reconstitute themselves with the French, and then go after them. And that took another month of action before the French actually came. And the French ultimately did not reinforce them because they simply couldn't do it in the eyes of the world. And so the extremists gave a lot of ground to the Tutsis, who immediately took it up and ultimately won. But there's still this, as I describe in my book, and what you can look at Rwanda today, which is very much a Tutsi-dominated society now, in regards to authority and governance and the like, is the fact that why did they take 100 days to win? Did they have to see 800,000 of their own slaughtered to win that war?
And of course, that's a question that I have. They certainly had a military force. It was a well-disciplined military force. It was mm-hmm. Our military force, at least, you know, from your description of them. Why did they wait 100 days before they moved in?
Well, and there is an interesting scenario that follows this, is that immediately after them winning the war and declaring their government in place by the 18th of July, within days, the diaspora start coming in and start displacing even the Tutsis who had survived. And when I went back for the 10th anniversary and met with a number of the Tutsi survivors, they were saying that they often are treated as collaborators and not as survivors, and have received very little support from the government. And so you got to start wondering exactly what was the plan behind the Tutsis in regards to their campaign. Did they really want to protect all the Tutsis and moderate Hutus by their deployment, which they said is why they were actually launching their offensive finally? Or, in fact, was there an ulterior plan to possibly the Tutsis retaking the country as they had control of it before the revolution of 59? And I must tell you that the jury is out on that debate.
Well, I certainly, if you don't know, I certainly don't know, but I have a very uneasy feeling that there's much more to this story than we really know today.
Absolutely. And that is why, in fact, the media were terribly unhelpful in this, because right from the start, one, they had very little information on what was going on in Rwanda, and two, they banalized it, they trivialized it, by saying it was nothing more than tribal activity. And these guys in Africa, they've been at each other's throat for centuries, and it's sort of in their genes. And so, you know, let it happen, and then we'll pick up the pieces afterwards. not realizing that there is a lot more at play, a lot more sophisticated power exchanges and control going on by a sophisticated elite society, and as such, we're not in the real heart of trying to solve it, and that's why we ended up with so little support.
I'm sure that is absolutely right. Well, we're going to just take one quick break, and then we'll certainly wrap up the program. What lesson do you think the world should learn by what happened in Rwanda? General?
Yes.
What?
No, sorry, I was listening to the music.
Right. Well, listen, wait a minute. We'll be through the music here in just a moment.
The lesson to be learned is the question that we must ask ourselves, are all humans human?
All right.
Or are some more human than others?
All right, we're going to be back in just a minute and wrap up the program here with General Tellier. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly the general raises a question, and the question we raise very often here on the program, a question that he really raises in the title of his book, Shake Hands with the Devil. And really, I think for most people, it's very difficult to believe that anything could really be that evil. Was that sort of the thing that really impressed you, as you had to see and face this and really were incapable of stopping it?
Well, at first we were quite prepared to face massacres. When I deployed there originally, Burundi had just had a coup d'etat, and we ended up with hundreds of thousands of refugees and tens of thousands of people killed. And so we were expecting that. But never could I even imagine that we would go to a genocide, because to me, genocide, from my education here, North American education, it was synonymous to Holocaust, and I couldn't imagine a Holocaust happening again. And so it totally came as an overwhelming impact that, yeah, we were in the middle of a genocide, and that people had actually decided that to solve a political problem, they would literally eliminate another race. And you sort of wonder what they've been doing in Darfur, and whether or not in Darfur they were trying to do the same thing.
I really fear that there is a tremendous element of man's inhumanity to man. And until we chase the hearts of men, we're never going to be able to solve the problems either in Africa or anywhere else in the world.
But it's going to happen. I remain optimistic. And that's what the book attempts in its conclusion to bring forward, is the fact that because there is so much more dynamic interest and action on human rights, because rule of law is becoming more and more to the fore, and we have international elements that, one, the UN still there trying to be more effective. We have the International Criminal Court to fight impunity, that I honestly believe that ultimately we will vanquish this desire of friction between the different peoples, and that we will create a serenity that is the heart of what the human being is. It's not a being that wants to fight in conflict. The heart of the human being is a heart of serenity, and that we will achieve. It might take a couple centuries, but we can keep working at it, and I believe we're going down that road.
Well, General, thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure, and I hope our listeners out across America and really the world, because this program is heard throughout the world, will certainly get your book and read it, and we'll tell them how to get the book right afterwards. Do you have a website at all?
Yes, it is.
Hold that thought. We'll just get that in a moment here.
Okay.
This is Dr. Stan, and how can people get to your website, General?
It's www.romeodallaire.com.
Romeo Dallaire altogether?
It's Romeo Dallaire.
One word, okay.
Yeah.
God bless you, Colonel. Well, General, thank you so very much for being with us.
All the best to you.
And to you too, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, fine. Bye. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the program here, and I certainly with a very heroic gentleman who written a wonderful, wonderful book, and it's called Shake Hands with the Devil. And how do you understand what's going on in the world today? Well, if I could suggest one thing that might help you, it would be my talk, Plan Population Reduction. And if you will get it, it's 2.5 hours of me talking, and I apologize for that, but really we needed even more time to bring out all the things that are going on today, which are so unbelievable. And whether it be diseases or wars or all of these things, there is a plan, a master plan. It's written out. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want you to know. So let me suggest either the video or the DVD, and you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and ask for planned population reduction. And now we do have 4 tape sets on population control. We have 4 tapes. We have a video on population control. We have my population control agenda monograph, where we even talk about the what happened in Rwanda. We have a 4-tape set called The Other Holocaust in it that gives you other information on what happened as far as Rwanda was concerned. Ladies and gentlemen, you must understand what we're really up against. You must understand the significance of the Georgia Guidestones and the message there. You must understand the writings of people like Jacques Cousteau, who talks about the necessity of eliminating 350,000 people a day. And if you doubt that that could be true, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And we'll be glad to send you the pages from the UNESCO Courier, November of 1991, where he is quoted as making that statement. You must understand that there are people who have a different worldview, who march to a different drumbeat, who dream a different dream, who worship a different God, because we're involved in the spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. I hope any of you want to get a copy of this, actually this talk we had today, this interview with General Dallaire. And then I hope many of you will certainly want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You'll want to get the little pamphlets we have on the occult hierarchy. The occult hierarchy that rules the world is basically 3 pamphlets, each one about 40 pages, a compilation of my letters that take you through the background of what's really going on behind the scenes. So, of course, they're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. And again, of course, General Dallaire's book is Shake Hands with the Devil. There really is organized evil in the world today. Planned population reduction will introduce you to it in a manner that no other means that I know will. And, of course, there really are secret societies out there. If you doubt that, we have a book written by the Librarian of Congress. It's called Fire in the Minds of Men, written by James H. Billington, the Librarian of Congress, who tells you that the World Revolution began in 1776 and is still going on today. So, again, our website is www.radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com, where you can listen to our programs 5 hours a day on the Internet. And, of course, you can get our shortwave sites, you can listen to our archive programs, you can pull down our programs in MP3 format, that's MP3, and of course you can get us on Telstar 5 if you'd like to listen 9 hours a day, and then to our other people who are working with us there, Joyce Riley and Chuck Chrismeyer. But Paul, you need to help us get the information out. You've got to copy our programs and get them to other people's hands, and then pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty. If you'd like a free copy of our latest newsletter, give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.